We're very pleased that you're here, and I think you'll find this a most wonderfully interesting session that will provoke a great deal of thought on the part of all of us. May I just say that this lecture and the ones to follow in the remainder of the two academic terms are made possible by a bequest from the late Mr. William G. Murn, who specified in his will his desire to promote the discussion and the interaction of the Christian implications with up to scholarship, the interaction of the two. And so we're very pleased today to have an excellent speaker to conform to the wishes of Mr. Murn and to address us all. And I'm going to ask now Dr. Victor Ling, who is the Vice President of Research at the BC Cancer Agency, to introduce the speaker.
Good afternoon. This year, 2003, we are celebrating the 50th anniversary of the discovery of the structure of DNA by Watson and Crick. This year, we are also celebrating the completion of the sequence of the human genome, a multinational effort coordinated by our speaker today, Dr. Francis Collin. This human genome project has been considered by many to be the most impressive and most ambitious undertaking of our time, and some have suggested that the Human Genome Project will have a greater impact on society, greater than the Industrial Revolution. Obviously, time will tell, but this is a big project. So I feel particularly privileged this afternoon to be able to introduce Dr. Francis Collin and be asked to do that. I actually feel quite inadequate. However, I did go on the web to find out a little bit about Dr. Collin. I know of him from his scientific work. I just want to find out a little bit more about him as a person. And today I had the privilege of shadowing him all day. One thing I know for sure, starting at 7 this morning until now, he's hard to shadow. He has enormous stamina. He is a remarkable communicator and someone that is very easy to speak with and get to know. But the web page about Dr. Collin says that he was raised on a farm in a small town in Virginia, probably walked to school. Oh, no, he didn't walk to school. He was homeschooled until sixth grade, then took chemistry degree in University of Virginia, took his PhD in physical chemistry at Yale, went to North Carolina for his medical degree, did residency in Chapel Hill, went back to Yale to do human genetics, where he learned the technique or developed the technique of position cloning, looking at large stretches of DNA. And he used that technology when he had his own lab in Michigan to clone and identify genes that are important for human diseases, such as cystic fibrosis. Today, he is the director of the Human Genome Institute at the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda in Washington, and considered to be the most visible and outstanding spokesperson for genome science, the Human Genome Project. Dr. Collin is a very serious scientist, a serious physician, a serious policymaker, and when interviewed by, I guess with PBS, asking him about his faith and what a Christian he was, he said he was a serious Christian. And his public policy and scientific endeavor has always been open to public scrutiny, and he enjoys the exchange of debate, willing to change his mind. And I find him remarkable that, especially amongst the scientific circle, that he willingly put his own faith for public scrutiny. And this afternoon, we're extremely privileged to hear Dr. Collin to talk about his personal journey from the perspective of someone who is at the pinnacle of the scientific world and how it affects his faith. So without further ado, I would like to welcome and ask you to welcome Dr. Collins as he speaks on Are We More Than Our Genes? Please welcome Dr. Collins.
Well, thanks, Victor. Good afternoon to all of you. I'm very impressed with the turnout of people on a perfectly beautiful fall afternoon here in Vancouver. I've been looking forward to the opportunity to have a dialogue with all of you about this topic, the interface between science and faith, and I hope we will get to the point of having those questions and answers before I waste away the entire afternoon. But I do have some things I would like to put first on the table, so I am going to go on a little bit here about my own perspective on this topic, a topic that I think confuses a lot of people, frightens some people, causes some people to just say, I'll think about that some other day. And yet a topic which, if we're really honest with ourselves, ought to probably be at the very top of our list of important questions. Is there a God? Does he care about me? I'm glad that this is the kind of university where those questions can be asked in this kind of a forum. I should tell you that I come here as a human being, and you may not agree with some of the perspectives that I've developed, and that's fine. And I should also clarify that I'm really going to talk to you this afternoon as a human being, although I happen to be a human being who's in charge of the human genome research effort in the United States. But mostly I'm going to be talking about today the interface that I have found between that aspect of science and what I believe as somebody who, as I will tell you, came to my faith not as a child, but at the age of 27, and how I integrate those things, because I find it very satisfying to integrate them. And I think a lot of people imagine that that might be difficult for somebody, particularly somebody working in biology. And I would like to tell you some of the ways in which I have found it not only to be okay, manageable, but actually to be quite satisfying. So I come here with some trepidation. Robert Jastrow, the noted astronomer, began his own book on the implications of science for religion with the following words. When a scientist writes about God, his colleagues assume he is either over the hill or going bonkers. So perhaps I should ask the question myself. I don't think I'm over the hill, and I don't think I'm going bonkers, but there are probably people who would assume that in terms of a scientist taking on this topic. I'm glad that this forum is one in which that kind of discussion has been freely held and will be freely held again in multiple other sessions. And I congratulate the leaders of this forum for making the possibility real to have this kind of a discussion. It's troubling to me, though, how deep the chasm can sometimes be between science and faith. Looking from the science side, for instance, I pull out a quotation from this past year where we've been in a great deal of excitement about the completion of the human genome sequence and the 50th anniversary of Watson and Crick's discovery of the double helix. Article from the Washington Times back last spring. The two scientists who discovered the structure of DNA in Cambridge 50 years ago have used the anniversary to mount an attack on religion. It goes on to say, speaking recently, Francis Crick, 86, said, quote, the God hypothesis is rather discredited. Later down the story, his co-discoverer, James Watson, 74, an American, said that religious explanations are, quote, myths from the past. I will try to convince you that those scientists are speaking outside of the data. That if one wished to draw a conclusion about the existence of God, that the double helix is not the place to find that answer. And yet, here is a very prominent pair, probably the most widely known names in all of science, using this occasion to basically say religion is outdated. So here is one perspective on the chasm between science and faith. The chasm looks just as deep, it seems, from the faith side, as witness the many attacks from Galileo onward, although they've probably been, to a certain degree, misquoted, by organized religion against scientific discoveries, and as witness the current circumstance with creationism, particularly young Earth creationism, which asks serious people to disbelieve practically the entire body of many disciplines of science, which is not a happy circumstance to ask serious seekers to make a decision. So there's a long and tumultuous relationship here, characterized by misunderstanding, distrust, a sense by each of these parties that maybe the other is out to get them. And I find that very sad. I'm comforted, though, by the fact that this particular sense of the absolutely unavoidable discordance between science and faith, which is characterized by comments from those at the poles of this discussion, are not shared by the majority who seem to be in the middle. There's a recent survey in the Scientist magazine a couple of months ago where they asked their readers, and people who read the Scientist are for the most part scientists. It's kind of the people magazine of a working bench scientist. So it's got all sorts of scuttlebutt, and occasionally they do these surveys. So they did a survey on science and religion. And I was surprised to see 59% of their respondents are currently associated with a religion, and half of those, roughly, indicate that they have a strong connection with that religion, that this is not a social experience, this is something that goes more deep than that. That's reassuring. Another survey done about 10 years ago by Nature, asking scientists who were actually leaders in their field, do you believe in a personal God? Found the answer roughly 25% saying yes, which was about the same proportion that said that 100 years earlier. So it is clear that a significant number of scientists, albeit probably a minority, not a majority, do find it quite harmonious to be both a rigorous, show-me-the-data kind of scientist and also somebody who believes in a personal God. And I count myself in that group. And I'd like maybe to take a little bit of time to explain how I arrived at that and how it makes sense to me from an intellectual, rational perspective. To do so, I think I have to explain a little bit about my own history. So this will be a more personal kind of presentation than I usually give when I'm giving a scientific seminar, as I did earlier today. I'm going to tell you about the two worldviews that coexist within me at the moment, the scientific worldview and the spiritual worldview. And some might argue, well, you've got to have one or the other, and I'm going to tell you that I don't think that's right, that I think both of those worldviews can coexist quite comfortably within the same person. They coexist within me. But let me just touch briefly on how I arrived at them. First, the scientific worldview. As you heard, I grew up in an environment where I was taught at home. My parents were interested in the arts and literature and theater, but not in science. That was not sort of part of our family tradition. But I got excited about science, as many of you, I bet, did, who are in science because of a high school teacher, because I did go to high school. I skipped the first six grades by staying at home, but after that had to deal with the discipline of public school and was fortunate enough to encounter a 10th grade teacher of chemistry who got me very excited about what science could do. So, of course, I decided to be a chemist. Biology did not interest me in the slightest at that point. It was way too messy. The way it was taught to me, it wasn't clear that biology even made sense. It seemed all very descriptive, and there didn't seem to be any principles, and that was a problem. It was not until I was well into a graduate program in physical chemistry at Yale that I realized that I'd been wrong about that. There was DNA, there was RNA, there was protein. Why did I not know this? Gee, life does make sense. There are principles. This is really elegant stuff. It appeals to the digitally minded. That was me. A physicist could love this stuff. And certainly a chemist could. So in some disarray, I decided to go to medical school to keep my options open while I sorted this all out. Why any medical school let me in with that kind of argument of motivation is still a bit of a mystery. But I'm glad they did, because I immediately found that I loved this. That medicine was extremely satisfying from the point of view of both the intellectual and the emotional part of it, which I'd sort of missed as a graduate student, sort of toiling away in the computer center worrying about quantum mechanics. So I applied myself to medical school, and along the way, I became a believer, and I'll tell you about that shortly. Also along the way, I decided that genetics was the area that I was most interested in because of its connection to this set of principles that I was so enamored of, this digital instruction book that was capable of carrying out all these wonderful aspects of biology in all species, and which also could have mistakes in it that would cause illness, and maybe we could figure out what to do about that. So after my medical school career and internship and residency, I went on and did a fellowship in human genetics, and ended up on the faculty at Michigan, and then came to NIH to lead the Human Genome Project there in 1993. And what a wild ride that has been for the last 10 years. Good heavens. Had the great privilege of working with some of the best and brightest minds in the field, people who are constantly amazing all of us with their creative ideas, a wonderful interdisciplinary atmosphere. So in any given day, I get to work with physicists and biologists and physicians. I get to work with computer scientists and engineers. I get to work with ethicists and theologians because of all of the implications of this project. And many ethical problems have come out of this enterprise, as you no doubt are aware. So that's sort of my scientific path and my scientific worldview. But what about the spiritual one? Where did that come from? Again, I'm going to be personal here because I think I owe you that kind of an explanation. I don't intend to embarrass you. I hope I don't embarrass me. My parents, wonderful teachers that they were not interested in matters to do with the spirit. I was, however, sent to church to learn music because there was a boys' choir in our local town, which was a very good way to learn music. But I distinctly remember my father instructing me not to pay too much attention to the rest of the stuff that was being talked about. And I didn't understand it, and it didn't appeal to me that much anyway, so I followed his direction. I had only the vaguest idea about what theology was about. Despite 10 years of sitting in the choir loft every Sunday, I couldn't have told you the first thing about Abraham, Moses, King David, or Jesus Christ. So I went to college, and you know what happens in college. Every college dormitory has somebody there whose goal it is to destroy the faith of all the freshmen, and I had one of those too. And he asked me a lot of penetrating questions about what I believed, and it was pretty clear to me I didn't know, and I had no foundation to respond to. And his arguments that this was all out of superstition seemed comfortable. And they were particularly comfortable because I think, like many at that point in their lives, it was convenient not to take too much stock in faith. I slipped into what C.S. Lewis has called willful blindness. Not so much a not knowing, but a desire not to know. Because knowing might somehow interfere with what was currently a fairly unconstrained lifestyle. It was the 60s. So what was I at that point? I guess I was an agnostic at the time, although I didn't know what an agnostic was. I was basically somebody who didn't know, didn't want to know, and wasn't sure that this was something that I should pay attention to because it might open up areas that I didn't want to think about. So I went on to graduate school, this time in physical chemistry, got immersed in the mathematical description of the universe, became very enamored of Einstein, Dirac, Heisenberg, Bohr, all of these amazing intellects. And I became convinced that everything in the universe could basically be explained by second-order differential equations and a few other basic principles. Never mind that Heisenberg pointed out the indeterminacy of such a universe. That was a bit irritating, but certainly not enough to cause me to abandon this growing sense of overarching determinism. I didn't pay much of attention to the increasing evidence at that point that the universe must have had a definite beginning some 15 billion years ago. That might have posed some dilemmas about what came before that, but I didn't really stop to worry much about that. And I assumed science has the ability to answer everything. So no longer an agnostic, I became a full-blown atheist. I was the one in the Department of Chemistry at Yale who you wouldn't want to have lunch with if you were bold enough to mention that you had some use for faith in your life, because it would have been my goal to point out to you that was all irrational superstition and that religion had basically been a negative force throughout the history of the world. It would not have been an amusing conversation. But at that time, as I mentioned, I realized that I wanted to change fields, and I ended up in medical school, which had certainly not been part of the life plan, but I guess most of you would agree that life plans these days generally can be reached about a year or two ahead, and then after that, who knows what's going to happen. And this was a very different setting. It was particularly a very different setting when I got to the clinical years, and I found myself sitting at the bedside of a series of amazing saints, people who had done wonderful things with their lives and who nonetheless had been afflicted with terrible diseases, not of their own making. And many of these people in this small hospital in North Carolina were strong believers. And I was really puzzled by that. If anybody should be shaking their fist at God, it was these people. And yet instead, they seemed to have this remarkable sense of strength and determination to accept whatever came based upon that faith. And I was puzzled. I assumed this was a psychological crutch, but it was clearly a rather powerful one. And the most awkward moments for me was when one of these people would turn to me and say, "Well, what do you believe?" And my atheism and materialism suddenly felt very thin, very lacking in substance, and very ill-supported, because what I had to admit as those people asked me those questions was, I'd never considered the data on this one. I was a scientist. I was supposed to consider the data before drawing a conclusion. And I had drawn the conclusion that God did not exist without really looking at the evidence, pro or con, based on very sketchy interactions with people who had particular perspectives and never really looking in a systematic way at whether there might be actually a rational basis for faith. My assumption had sort of been that wouldn't be likely, that faith was something you arrived at because you had it hammered into your head when you were little or you had some emotional experience. The idea that it might be possible to come to faith rationally was not something I'd seriously considered, but I figured, well, if that is a possibility, I'd better look into that, because otherwise I'm going to have a hard time fighting off these various questions. So I set out to look at the evidence, and I read about various religions. I got kind of confused. There was a lot of complexity there, a lot of similarities, a lot of differences. I felt I needed help. I went and met with a Methodist minister who lived a couple of doors down, who turned out to be very patient, listened to my blasphemous queries, and after a couple of discussions suggested that if I was really interested in the logical basis for belief in God, there was a little book that I ought to read. And he took the book down from his shelf and he handed it to me. And within a day, my life had really changed. And that book was C.S. Lewis, Mere Christianity. If you haven't read that book, this would be a very useful place to start in your own search for whether or not there is truth to be found in faith or whether it's all a series of superstitions. Because Lewis, an Oxford scholar, a very distinguished one, known for his own work in literary criticism, had followed, it seemed, the same path I had. Starting out with some sense of belief, losing it completely during his college years, and then very much more so in the First World War, becoming a brilliant young scholar, and then realizing that there were people around him who still clung to what he perceived to be an old superstition called faith, and he set about to disprove this so that he wouldn't have to listen to their arguments. And the more he tried to disprove it, the more he became convinced that the arguments in favor of faith were a lot more compelling than the ones against it. And ultimately, to his horror, he converted himself. So this was an interesting pathway. And I thought, well, I'll never fall into that trap. But reading his book, I began to realize that all of the arguments that I had put together that basically argued that faith could not be rational were full of holes. Holes that basically a child could have figured out if they'd stared at the logic for more than a few minutes. But it was not logic that I had really wanted to consider flawed before. It was too threatening, and now I was facing up to it. Particularly compelling in Lewis's book, in the very first chapter, something which still has considerable appeal to me as one of the strong rational underpinnings for belief not only in a God, but in a personal God, is what he calls the law of human nature, or the moral law. And these concepts are not unique to Lewis. They've been around for centuries, but he's a particularly articulate presenter of them. So what is this? This law is so universal to humankind, so familiar in everyday experience, that some of us never even stop to ask the question of its origins. What is it? Well, it's quite simply the innate knowledge of good and evil, the ability to perceive right and wrong. So whenever you hear somebody disagreeing about something, it's with someone else, it's likely that they're each appealing to this law to try to support their argument. An example taken from current events in the U.S. One might argue, well, we were forced to invade Iraq to prevent that evil Saddam Hussein from threatening the entire world with suffering and destruction. Another says, no, unilateral aggression by the United States toward Iraq without overwhelming evidence and worldwide support has squandered the moral stance of our country. Now, neither party is saying, to hell with your concept of right and wrong. Both are arguing their position is more consistent with right and moral behavior. That's just accepted. It's not even considered as a point of disagreement. But they are each trying to say that theirs is the right position and the other's is not. Now, it's interesting. While one might call this a law, it's not like the law of gravity, which we're basically forced to adhere to. The moral law is one which nobody adheres to. Probably for 30 minutes, you might be able to adhere to this moral law, and in every instance presented to you during those 30 minutes, actually do the thing which you know in your heart is the right thing to do. And most of the time, it's hard to sustain that. Now, we make a lot of excuses about, well, that person was rude to me, so it was all right to say those things, or I was under a lot of pressure. But the need to make those excuses only confirms how much we all believe in the law itself. Otherwise, we wouldn't bother. So what's about this? What is this law, and why is it so universal amongst humankind? And it is, by the way. Another book of Lewis's, The Abolition of Man, has a wonderful appendix in it, which goes through a lot of historical and anthropological assessments to ask the question, is this really a universal law, or is this cultural? And it's absolutely, with some exceptions only in terms of circumstances often associated with serious mental illness or other derangements, it seems as if virtually all of the groups that were studied, all down through the ages, seemed to adhere to this law. They had different interpretations of what exactly was the moral action, but nobody really seemed to disagree about the fact that moral actions are the ones that we should strive for. So why is it there? Why is it universal? I'll return to some explanations that have been provided by evolutionary psychologists in a little bit, because some of you may be thinking, well, of course, this is a survival of the species kind of motivation. And I think that has a certain credibility, but I think it also has a number of problems. And it basically doesn't do it for me. So if that's not the answer, what is the story here? Well, wouldn't this be, if you were looking for evidence of God, the exact place to look for it, especially if you were looking for evidence of a God who was personally interested in human beings, not the kind of deist God that went off and started the universe and then disappeared from view, but a God who actually is invested and interested in each of us? Where would we look to find him if not here, if not in this most inner sense of what is right and holy and what is not right and not holy? That plausible conclusion, that's not a proof, but it's a plausible conclusion of Lewis's, that God has written this law within me and within all of humankind, was for me very compelling, and it remains so to this day. I had to conclude, based on that, that an intelligence in the universe, an intelligence that stands for what is good and holy, and who cares in some way with human beings, is a more plausible answer than to assume the negative. So that got me to the first step, sort of a willingness to believe in a personal God. But I'm still a long way away from the God of Christian faith at this point in the logical deduction. So if this is acceptable, a dilemma immediately arises. If God is perfect and holy, and this argument would say that he is, and I'm not, because once I begin to realize my transgressions on the moral law, I realize just how frequent they are. How can I ever bridge this chasm in order to be able to have some kind of relationship with God, which is that hunger, that longing, which is also one of universal characteristics of humankind, that longing for something outside ourselves? How can that ever be satisfied if what I am longing for is so completely impossibly different from me? Well, I studied the religions of the world looking for answers. I puzzled over many of them, pantheism, Buddhism, Hinduism, and I found many things there that were very appealing. I tried to understand the differences between the three great religions that trace their origins to Father Abraham, and I studied the lives of leaders and prophets of these faiths, and again, was comforted by what they have in common. But what struck me most profoundly were the astonishing claims of one single figure in all of these stories of faith, the claim not just to know God, but to be God. And that was the claim of Jesus of Nazareth. Reading the book of John in the New Testament, I finally did get around to reading what the Bible had to say about this. That was probably a good thing to do. I encountered Jesus' words, John 8:58. I tell you the truth, before Abraham was born, I am. Not much ambiguity there. John 10:30, I and the Father are one. Now this was very troubling because it forced a choice, and Lewis again points this out in clear terms in the concluding paragraph in his chapter in Mere Christianity called The Shocking Alternative. Once you recognize that Christ made such outlandish claims, then you really do have to decide how to deal with that. And Lewis writes, I am trying here to prevent anyone saying the really foolish thing that people sometimes say about Jesus. Quote, I'm ready to accept Jesus as a great moral teacher, but I don't accept his claim to be God. That is one thing we're not allowed to say. A man who was merely a man and said the things that Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher. He would either be a lunatic on the level with a man who says he's a poached egg, or else he would be the devil of hell. You have to take your choice. Either this man was and is the Son of God, or else a madman or something worse. You can shut him up for a fool. You can spit at him and kill him as a demon. Or you can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God. But let us not come with any patronizing nonsense about his being a great human teacher. He has not left that open to us. He did not intend to. Powerful words. What a choice. So I found myself either having to say everything about what Christ taught is fallacious, or he really was who he said he was. And if that claim was true, then this is the most remarkable claim in all of human history, and it deserves my very close attention to every other aspect of what that means. And most profoundly, I began to realize this also solved my problem, this sense of being so separated from this longing for a relationship with God, because Christ provided the perfect solution to that yawning gap, having been here as man, but also as God. That was the person by which I could cross over. It seemed then to me that most other religions that I read about sounded like man in search of God. This was God in search of man. So I'd started on this journey to confirm my atheism, and instead I found that this kind of intellectual argument had carried me up to the threshold of belief, but I wasn't yet really a believer. And at some point, one comes to the moment where you really have to take that leap. I would argue that logic can bring you right to that edge of the cliff. Logic can certainly bring you to the conclusion that being a believer is more plausible than being an unbeliever. I think that conclusion has been reached by many people who've really considered the evidence. But it doesn't get you all the way off the edge of the cliff, leaping out, taking your chances that this is going to be a leap that will be sustainable, that will save you. And so I struggled with that. And it's interesting that I'm here actually in Vancouver, because I was realizing last night coming in from the airport at a late hour that Vancouver had two major significances for me exactly 25 years ago, because I came here to a genetics meeting, my first ever, and it was the point at which I became convinced I wanted to work in the field of human genetics right here in Vancouver, because the American Society of Human Genetics was meeting here. But the other thing that happened on that trip is relevant to the spiritual side of me that I'm just telling you about. Because I've been wrestling with this issue about whether to take that leap or not for months. It was miserable. I talked to a lot of people. None of them really had enough answers to make me sure what the right thing to do was. I could not stop thinking about this, but I couldn't seem to resolve it. And I decided, since I was coming to Vancouver and I had an extra afternoon, that I would actually drive in a rental car, because I'd never been to the Northwest before, and drive through the Cascade Mountains on the way here. It was a beautiful day like today. I went for a hike in the mountains and turned a corner and saw this amazing sight of a creek which had frozen coming down a cliff. Just one of those moments where you're awed by the beauty of everything around you. And something about that moment, a quarter of a century ago, probably no more than 100 miles from here, caused me to be certain that I could not go another second without making this decision. So that was the day that it happened. And 25 years after that fact, I can tell you that was the most significant decision, the most meaningful decision the most satisfying decision that I've ever made. Yes, I've been assaulted by doubts on a regular basis, particularly the first year after that decision. It was not an easy road, but I was fortunate to have thoughtful and patient people around me, especially scientist believers, to handle my many dilemmas and crises and questions. And now I can tell you that really faith is the guiding light of my life. It's the answer to questions that otherwise don't have answers. And it is a rock that I can stand on in the midst of the many storms that life brings along. So that's my spiritual worldview and how I got to it. But now you may be saying, and you're a geneticist? How does that work? What about evolution in the Bible? What about all these other arguments about the incompatibility of the spiritual worldview and rigorous science? Do you have to check your brain at the door when you go to church? I've actually been asked that. Well, happily, I think those all have good answers. But I think they're answers that maybe aren't as widely distributed as they might be. And people come to their answers in different ways. So I want to spend the rest of the time explaining to you how, from my perspective, these are not only worldviews that can be forced together. They actually coexist quite happily and are complementary. And I'm enormously grateful that I have a chance as a scientist to also see things as a believer, and as a believer to also see things from the perspective of science. So why are these worldviews not incompatible then, you might ask? Well, the basic reason, and this is pretty obvious, science, what does it do? It explores the natural world. Is God part of the natural world? Well, there are some faiths that accept that premise. That's not the faith that I adhere to. God certainly seems to me like a supernatural phenomenon, if God has any meaning at all. So science is probably, therefore, not going to be the appropriate tool to apply to try to understand what God is like. And hence, as I read those quotes from Watson and Crick, I think they're committing a logical fallacy by saying, because of science, we can now say that we don't need God. It's like a disconnect. Science has very little to tell us about whether we need God or whether God exists. God is not part of our natural world. So let me go through a series of 5 points that I think help perhaps straighten some of these issues out a little bit. First of all, if you're a rigorous scientist, you may very well say, so why do we need the supernatural? Why consider it? Now, I've gone through my own arguments about the moral law, and there are others like that that I think rationally demand one to get a little beyond the tools of science in understanding some of the fundamental issues of what it means to be a human with a mind that has this sense of right and wrong. But beyond that, consider a circumstance where the only questions worth asking are scientific questions. What kind of a world would that be? Well, here are some questions that science, I think, has really nothing to offer on. What is the meaning of life? What happens after we die? Is there a God? If so, does he care about me? We're here in a university. Surely those are some of the most fundamentally important questions that any human being ever asks. And yet science is essentially powerless to give you anything more than a fairly superficial answer to any of those. You won't find papers published in Science or Nature on the topic of what is the meaning of life. You may find them in other publications, but probably not in the rigorous scientific journals. So if you accept the importance of asking those questions, then you have to, I think, accept the importance of considering things outside of science as being worthy of at least some passing attention. Second argument, and here's one which I think one shouldn't go too far with, but it actually, I think, is a source of some interesting discussion. Let's admit, shall we, that even science, as applied to the natural world, leaves us with some mysteries that we're having a very hard time explaining, at least a few of which we probably will not be able to explain no matter how far science develops. That is to say, there are aspects of the natural world that seem to fall outside of science's ability to measure or to deduce the explanation. So, the first and obvious one, how did the universe get here? What was before the Big Bang? I think it's not an accident that cosmologists, of all the fields of science, seem to have the highest proportion of believers compared to others, because this is a very tough question to answer with the laws of physics And it does not seem likely that a good answer will be forthcoming. A second argument of this same sort within the context of the fact that science can't necessarily give us all the answers we need is what's been called the anthropic principle. If this one doesn't appeal to you, don't worry too much about it, but I think it appeals to a lot of people as one of those puzzles that seems to scream for an explanation. Now, what is this anyway? Well, it's basically the observation that the precise nature of a certain series of physical constants in our universe turns out to have been tuned to a remarkably fine degree to make the existence of the universe as we know it possible. A physicist has written that if the rate of expansion of the early universe in those first few minutes were only one part in 10 to the 14th power smaller, the universe would have recollapsed before it could have formed stars and galaxies. If this expansion rate were increased by only one part in 10 to the 14th, the universe would expand too rapidly to permit density fluctuations in the early universe to condense into bound systems like galaxies. An incredibly finely tuned system to make it feasible for us to be here at all. Other examples, the strong and weak nuclear forces and various constants in electromagnetism also turn out to be exquisitely tuned for the existence of the universe. Even Stephen Hawking, not exactly a strong proponent of faith, has opined that the odds against a universe like ours emerging from something like the Big Bang are enormous. Physicist Freeman Dyson, who is a believer, writes, "I do not feel like an alien in this universe. The more I examine it and study the details of its architecture, the more evidence I find that the universe, in some sense, must have known we were coming." One can't help but feel a bit of a sense of wonder at all this. All of it recalls David's words in Psalm 19, "The heavens declare the glory of God, the skies proclaim the work of his hands." The counter-argument, of course, is, well, if the universe had not had those features, we wouldn't be here discussing it. And maybe there is an infinite possible number of universes that we don't know about, and the only one we know about is the only one we could have existed in. I don't find that very satisfying, but if it appeals to you, fine, go with it. Your faith will not rest or be destroyed by that particular argument. I think it is intriguing. Of all the possible ways the universe could have been put together, the way it did happen, a very unlikely one, is the one which made human life and this conversation a possible reality. A third area, which I think causes people a lot of trouble, so let's face up to it, is evolution. What about this? I think more people have lost their faith on the basis of evolutionary arguments than on a lot of other topics in the last 150 years since Darwin, and I'm going to argue with it that's wholly unnecessary. I am a biologist. I believe that the theory of evolution should no longer be called a theory. It is so well supported by so many pieces of evidence in terms of the way in which biological organisms are related to each other through a common ancestor, that to attack it on the grounds of being an unsupported theory really doesn't carry much weight in the serious scientific circles who are working hard on biology. And I must say, genomics has only added to the strength behind those arguments. Darwin could have hardly imagined a way to prove his theory, other than maybe a time machine, that would be more compelling than the study of the genome. When I look at the human genome and the mouse genome, and I find an area of DNA where I have genes lined up A, B, C in the same order in both species, and I can see that A is related to A, and B is related to B, and C is related to C, it's very compelling to say they must have come from a common ancestor that also had A, B, C in that order. And even more compellingly, if I look at the space in between A and B, there's stuff in there. There's a lot of junk. There are transposable elements that landed there a long time ago. Well, guess what? If there's a transposable element that's fairly ancient there in the mouse, and I go and look in the human, it's there too. You can't argue that that is... Well, you could argue. Is that a signal? I'm getting close. I don't think you can argue that that kind of presence of a transposable, non-functional element is an example of how, in a creationist view, God is using the same elements over and over again to accomplish a biological purpose, because this is, after all, a non-functional element that's been non-functional for 100 million years. Why should it still be there in the same place if it's not identical by descent? The only argument I could see at this point that would support the notion of special creation based upon that is that God is playing games with us to test our faith and basically designing creatures like this from scratch, putting in all of this stuff in exactly the way that would convince you that it had to come from a common ancestor, just to see if we would make that logical conclusion and then go, aha, fooled you. That doesn't sound like the God that I'm a worshiper of. So this doesn't appeal to me. So how do we get so far off on this topic? I think we have a real battleground going on. And I don't mean in the discussion of the battleground to say that the fault lies on only one side. After all, we have scientists such as Richard Dawkins who argue in book after book that evolution proves that God does not exist. Again, I think creating or committing the logical fallacy that science alone can actually disprove God, which I think is not something based on the arguments earlier discussed that is sensible. Fundamentalists, on the other hand, argue that evolution must be wrong because they're quite sure, based on Genesis 1 and 2, that God just wouldn't do things this way. So this is a new chapter, but it's a long history of conflicts between science and religion. These tend to arise when science attempts to comment upon the spiritual, usually to say it doesn't exist, or religion attempts to read various sacred texts like the Bible as though they were science textbooks, something which I would argue they were never intended to be. Again, the evidence in favor of biological evolution, in favor of the fact that the Earth is approximately 4.6 billion years old, is overwhelming. Those who would argue in the favor of young earth creationism should realize that they are not basically saying that we need to do a little tweaking around the edges of some of the sciences that support the other conclusion. Instead, I would say that if one wanted to accept that, basically you are arguing that the fundamental principles of geology, cosmology, biology, chemistry, and physics are all wrong. And if that is the position to be taken, one should really consider whether that is the direction that Genesis 1 is asking us to go. So, why have we gotten in this mess? I think we've gotten in this mess as a fairly recent development, by the way. The argument about the days of creation, as depicted in Genesis 1 being 24-hour days, was not one widely held until the fundamentalist movement, which came along about 100 years ago. Go back and read St. Augustine, 400 A.D., writing his interpretation of what the creation story is all about. Sounds a lot like mine. Basically, Augustine saying, God has a way of creating that we probably don't understand, but you can look at the world around you and see how creatures are probably related to each other in some, he didn't use the word evolution, but in some evolutionary way. There was nothing that Augustine, who had no reason to apologize because Darwin hadn't come along and wouldn't for a very long time, there was no reason that Augustine found to draw this conclusion that Genesis 1 had to be taken literally. And yet somehow, 100 years ago, a large segment of serious Christians began to take that tack and continue to do so to this day. And I think this is a terrible tragedy. It's a terrible tragedy, particularly for young people. People who are raised in a tradition which becomes very much a part of them, to be serious believers in God and in Jesus Christ as his son, and who are told, if you're going to be a serious believer, then you have to be opposed to evolution. We should not ask people to do that. When we do ask people to do that, we run a serious risk that after they've surveyed the scientific facts and realize just how overwhelmingly compelling they are, that they will turn sadly away from their faith, concluding that no God who would ask them to disbelieve this body of evidence would be a God that they'd want to worship. So I think this is a circumstance where clearly the church and the scientific community are at an unfortunate juncture, and I don't see at the present time a lot of evidence that this is getting better, but boy, does it need to. And we as people who are, some of us, both scientists and believers, have perhaps a very important responsibility to try to get this back on an even keel. So you might ask me, if that's my view, if young earth creationism is not the story of Genesis 1, then what is the story of Genesis 1, and what is the relationship of God the Creator to us as human beings? Well, I don't have a problem with this at all. And the reason I don't have a problem is because of a couple of things which make a lot of sense to me, and maybe we can talk about them if they don't make sense to you. Let's accept the fact that God, if God has any significance at all, is not limited in time and space the way that we are. God can both be in the past and in the future and in the present all at the same time. We're living on this flat land where we can't see. God is in three dimensions. God is in four dimensions. So even though evolution may seem to us like a random process that could have turned out almost any old way and not necessarily ended up resulting in us, and Stephen Jay Gould makes that kind of argument repeatedly, to God that's not the story at all. God already knew the outcome from the very beginning. So my synthesis is the following, and I find it a very comforting one, that God, who after all is not bounded by the limits of space and time as we are, in his wisdom decided to create a universe and decided to do so in a fashion that involved creatures with whom he could have fellowship, us. And he chose the remarkable mechanism of evolution to create microbes and plants and animals of all sorts. And he chose it ultimately with the intention of giving rise to creatures who would know the moral law and who would have a longing to seek him, and to whom he would ultimately reach out by himself becoming flesh and walking amongst us. And furthermore, as God is God and not limited by natural laws, I can accept that he on rare occasions has performed miracles which science is unable to judge since they fall outside the natural realm. I don't think those happen very often. I've never seen one happen in my own experience. But I can accept the possibility of such miracles. And most importantly to me, the birth, life, and death on the cross of Jesus Christ, whose literal resurrection from the dead is the very cornerstone of my belief. If you start watering down that part, you find that Christian faith is pretty well gone. So this position, as I've outlined it to you, is the one that I arrived at, I think, sort of feeling through the darkness, but subsequently discovered that most biologists, who are also serious believers, not all, have kind of come to this same synthesis. There are other ways to do this synthesis, but this seems to be a particularly satisfying one. It certainly is for me. And it's generally referred to as theistic evolutionism, the notion that evolution is, in fact, a valid conclusion from the data, but that evolution, although it appears as a random, blind process to us, was not so to God Almighty, who had a purpose in the whole thing and knew how it would turn out, even though we can't quite see how that would be. That, by the way, if you read the final words of Darwin's Origin of Species, is exactly the position that Charles Darwin also came to. So let me move on then to a conclusion, but I still have a couple more points about this interface between science and faith, and I want to quickly return to this argument about the moral law and whether it can be explained away on the basis of psychobiology or sociobiology. Also, sometimes the argument is based on evolutionary psychology. Because some would say, the reason we have this knowledge of right and wrong is because a species that didn't have it would not be able to survive very long, because it's very important that you have a sense not only of your own survival, which might cause you to do purely selfish things, but also of the survival of the entire species, which would then motivate you to do altruistic things to try to reach out to people who need help. On the surface of it, that sounds reasonable. So is that all it is? Is that all this moral law is? Well, I have a problem with that, because once you start to take it apart and look at specific examples, it doesn't work. Remember, evolution doesn't care about us. It only cares about our DNA. That's the only force that you as an evolutionist or an evolutionary psychologist are allowed to invoke in saying why something has come to be. Is that DNA going to be maintained or is it going to be lost? So while I can accept the notion about it's the DNA not necessarily just of individuals but of the species that matters, consider the following. You're walking on the bank of a river. You hear shouts for help. You see there is somebody out in the river who's clearly drowning. What is your impulse? Well, if you don't swim very well, your human impulse may be to say, this is too risky. But don't you somewhere know that the right thing to do is to try to save that person? Is that not a universal sort of sense of moral responsibility, even at some risk to yourself, even if it might cause you to die and not pass on your DNA? So already we're in a dilemma here. But now some will say, oh yeah, but that's because you need to save that other person so that they can pass on their DNA. Well, it doesn't work that way. Suppose that person is your sworn enemy. Certainly evolution works by survival of the fittest. Suppose that person is not a very fit person. You would say evolution would be driving you to say, let them drown. Their DNA isn't as important as mine is. Look what they got themselves into this pickle. Their kids would probably do the same thing. We don't need that. And yet that's not the impulse that you feel within you. Maybe you feel particularly within you the impulse, if this is somebody who has a disability, that you ought to go and help them. Exactly the opposite of what the evolutionary psychology argument would say. So it doesn't work for me. When you start looking at the details, the moral law cannot, as far as I can tell, be explained away on that kind of argument. And if it can't be explained away, that provides a great big problem for the strict evolutionist who are trying, I think, to explain all aspects of human behavior on this basis, including the problem of free will, by the way, which is also going to be a tough one for, I think, an evolutionary biologist to deal with, but makes perfect sense if you talk about a creator God. Well, to come to a conclusion, I don't know if all these arguments make sense to you, and I hope we can discuss this a little bit. I'll just give you one more metaphor that I think is helpful, particularly for those who may have arrived here this afternoon with a sense that science disproves God. Imagine that you're asked to draw a circle that represents all of the knowledge, scientific and non-scientific, that could ever exist within the universe. How big would that be? Well, draw it. And people will, if asked to do this, draw, of course, an enormously large circle. Now, within that circle, draw what you know. And even the most arrogant person will draw a pretty small little circle by comparison. Now, the argument goes, suppose that the knowledge of the existence of God exists outside your little circle, but in the bigger circle. That seems like a logical possibility. How then could anyone take the strict atheist position of saying, I know there is no God? From a purely logical position, it seems to me that says that atheism is the least rational of all. It requires the greatest degree of faith in your position. And it's a difficult one, I think, to maintain in a strictly intellectual argument. So in conclusion, I have to argue that based on my own experience, that those who choose to exclude the exploration of the spiritual world, even as scientists, are missing out on a really important aspect of life. In fact, I think the choice about whether or not to believe is arguably the most important one that a human being ever makes. Yet isn't it surprising how few of us in this modern age or postmodern age really take the time to investigate the evidence and reach a conclusion, oftentimes waiting until some personal crisis or the advance of age forces the issue. I hope that's not your situation. It was certainly mine for a long time until the age of 27. But could there be a more important question to focus on in an institution of higher learning than like this one than whether or not you believe in God? No one else can make that decision for you. Not your parents, not your family, not your friends, not your professors, and not your cultural tradition. For me, making that decision has been the most important one in my life. It empowers me as a scientist when I discover something to have a special aspect of that that is particularly meaningful, the sense that this is something that nobody else ever knew before, but God knew. And so in that sense, science also becomes an opportunity of worship, which is something I never dreamed until arriving at this synthesis of worldviews could be possible. But it is an intensely satisfying experience. So I would encourage you, if you're struggling with those issues, don't feel all alone. I think there are many aspects I haven't had time to touch on that do present genuine dilemmas for the scientist believer, but I fervently believe there are none that are not solvable, especially if we all keep talking to each other and depending on God to give us the wisdom when we can't find it anywhere else. There's a wonderful verse from James that hangs on my wall in wonderful calligraphy done by my daughter, who's now a physician in practice. And it says, if any man lacks wisdom, let him ask of God, who gives to all men generously and without reproach, and it will be given to him. I'm counting on that. My wisdom is always inadequate. His is never inadequate. Thank you very much. Questions?
It would seem that the biblical narrative indicates that human beings are at the top of the evolutionary process, that we're the pinnacle of the process. If you were to take evolution seriously, it would indicate that there's a possibility that we're not the pinnacle of the process, that in fact there could be something beyond us that's better and more improved or something. Does that produce a quandary?
That's a good question. It doesn't particularly for me, in part because evolution is such an incredibly slow and ponderous process, that it's difficult for me to factor that into the sort of historical context that we are talking in right now. It also seems that we have arrived at a point where evolution is not operating on human beings with the same kind of force that it did in the past, in that we, thank goodness, have figured out ways to treat illness, to help children that are born with certain medical problems to survive and reproduce. I think if human beings are going to evolve significantly in the future, it will probably be at our own hands and not as a consequence of natural selection. And that raises a whole host of ethical questions about, is that a good idea? If you accept my premise, and I know not all of you will, that God had the evolutionary process as part of a grand plan to result in creatures like human beings that he could have a relationship with. If we decide to take the process into our own hands and change our fundamental biology, are we evolving ourselves out of that relationship in a circumstance that would have real consequences for who we are as spiritual creatures? That gets us into metaphysical arguments pretty quickly, but it's a pretty important issue to think about in terms of long-term major re-engineering of the species, something which some people are advocating for, including Stephen Hawking, for that matter, but which I think those of us who are believers really have some pause about that kind of an outcome. But in terms of natural processes of evolution, it seems to me that has become more and more moot. Way up here in the back.
One of the challenges that I've heard is more theological in character. The New Testament statement that till sin, death did not enter the world stands on one side, and on the other stands my understanding of the natural selection process in which death is necessary.
So, yeah, I've looked at that issue because I know that does cause difficulties for a number of believers, and there are certainly people who have pointed to that as yet another reason why evolution must be wrong. As I read those texts, and go and read them very carefully and see what you think they're really saying, the death that seems to me that's being talked about there is not a physical death, it's a spiritual death. And so what I take from that is that until Adam, this imbuing of the moral law had not occurred, and therefore this likelihood of being separated from God hadn't occurred because there wasn't a relationship to begin with. So if you accept that interpretation, and I would really challenge you to look at the text and see whether that fits better than the notion that this was a physical death, then I don't see there's a problem at all. Then it seems that the process of life and death that we know around us now would be entirely consistent with what was going on even before the description of Adam and Eve. You want to respond?
Yeah, just in the light of that interpretation, how would you decide how to interpret say the end of that book?
Well, I think heaven is a different concept. And again, that death that's being described at the end of Revelation, which is a very mysterious and wonderful book of the Bible, where I think very serious believers will disagree as to, in terms of what it was that was in John's vision that he describes in that book. It seems to me that what is being described there is both physical and spiritual death, but maybe more of the spiritual. Again, in that circumstance, one arrives at a place of having fellowship with God where there is no more separation possibility, and so therefore there is no more death. But I think in that context, it's probably also referring to physical death. Let's come over here. Yes?
On the moral law, which assumes consciousness, and I'm thinking especially of our own human self-consciousness, and which leads to language, how do you account for human consciousness?
Oh, well, certainly from a scientific perspective, we don't have a lot of great answers about that one. It's interesting that Francis Crick has devoted the last 50 years of his life to trying to understand that. Since discovering the double helix, that's been the focus. And I think he would admit that at the present time, we really don't have a very good sense at all of what consciousness is all about or how it comes about biologically. I do think consciousness and the moral law are probably pretty inextricably intertwined. I can't imagine that you could have a sense of the moral law without consciousness. And as soon as you begin to have this sense of self-awareness, it seems that that's when the moral law appears in terms of the creatures on this planet that we're able to investigate in a way that we sort of understand, although there is some controversy about that. So I guess I also, without being able to defend this particularly strongly theologically, do consider that the appearance of consciousness in human beings may also kind of coincide with God's plan of having creatures who had free will, had a longing for a relationship with Him, and who also knew the difference between right and wrong. They all seem to sort of arrive at the same time. I don't know how satisfying that is, but that's the best I can do. Yes, in the red. Yes.
Yes. You mentioned theistic evolution. Can you comment on the idea of progressive creation? God created mankind. How can we create all sorts of creatures, large and small, using parts we've used before?
So progressive creation is one term for that. Another is intelligent design. I haven't talked about intelligent design, a series of ideas put forward by Philip Johnson and many others since that time over the last 10 years, which argue, and particularly this is argued in a much talked about book by Michael Behe called Darwin's Black Box, that maybe it doesn't make sense to say that evolution explains everything about the species. Maybe there are bits of evidence to suggest that God has carried out special acts of creation. The evidence that's pointed to are things such as the structure of the eye or the blood clotting system or the many proteins that go into making a mobile structure like a bacterial flagellum. Michael Behe would argue that those are structures of irreducible complexity and that they give you no evolutionary advantage until you've already developed many components and put them together. So how would you ever develop the components if they didn't provide you with a selective advantage until all of the components had been assembled? And that argument has been used by the proponents of intelligent design to say evolution maybe explains micro changes of organisms, but not macro changes. I have trouble with the arguments, although I think they're interesting, because when one looks carefully at the examples that are cited of irreducible complexity as greater and greater bodies of data get generated, they turn out not to be irreducible after all. So when you look at the parts, for instance, that go into the blood clotting system, while Behe argued in his book that you wouldn't get blood clotting until you had a whole bunch of different proteins all nicely tuned to interact with each other, there's actually very good evidence in various organisms that particular components of that system are functional for a slightly different purpose. And so the final step or steps of starting to put them together is not so irreducible in its complexity after all. The parts were already there, had already been selected for, and it is not, once you look more closely at it, a violation of the idea of how evolution should work. So I guess while I think intelligent design is an interesting set of developments, I am worried about it in the sense that it is once again being used in some religious circles as a test of one's faith. And that if you're a real believer, then, well, maybe you accept that evolution applies in the microevolutionary sense, but you don't accept it in the macro sense, and their intelligent design has to be the right view, otherwise you're not on the train. This is a God of the gaps kind of argument. And we've had those down through history, where people put God into a place where science had not yet come up with an explanation for a natural phenomenon. And then when science did come up with that explanation, we had a crisis of faith. I don't think we should be doing that to people here either, because my own feeling is that the gaps that are pointed to by the ID proponents are going to be filled in by additional knowledge, both in terms of genomics and protein structure and the fossil record, which has already filled in some of the gaps that people said were not going to be possible to identify in terms of intermediate species. So while it is still possible, I will allow quite happily the idea that God might have reached down and intervened somewhere in the evolutionary process, maybe several times. Again, I'm allowing God to be supernatural and do whatever he thinks is right. I don't find it necessary to invoke that. And I think to try to insist on that in the absence of overwhelming data drives people away from a serious consideration of whether they are going to accept such a God, because it seems to be basically playing in an unfair way with the laws of the universe in a fashion that we don't observe happening around us. So why should they have happened, or why should we have to insist that they happened to explain something like the relationship of species? Yes.
Would you be willing to comment briefly on your ethical concerns as a believer as related to the nonprofit?
So the question is, would I comment on my ethical concerns as a believer? Ethical concerns related to the Genome Project. Well, that's a great question. I didn't talk about that in this presentation, but it's certainly something that people do wonder about. I come to this project with a particular foundational set of beliefs. My moral compass is very much a consequence of where I stand as a believer. And yet I am also a government servant, a person who leads a project that is international in scope and involves all kinds of experts in all kinds of areas. And I know it would be improper for me to step in and impose my own personal view of a particular situation in terms of, well, that's the right thing to do and that's the wrong thing to do. I'm not shy to say what I think. And I'm also not shy to reveal, as I am doing this afternoon, what my own foundation comes from. But it would be, I think, the wrong thing for me to try to imply that I've got the corner on the market on an ethical dilemma that comes up in front of each of us almost every day in the area of genomics. I'm really grateful to have a foundation upon which to rest a sense of ethics. I think one of the great tragedies of the current time in the postmodernist era is that many people are without that foundation. There is no compass. It's just whatever seems right for the situation. And that's not very satisfying. And I certainly respect the bioethicists the most, secular or non-secular, who are willing to say, this is what I believe and this is why. What drives me crazy about some areas of bioethics is so much of this, well, on the one hand and on the other hand, and an unwillingness to basically say, from a moral perspective, this is wrong and this is okay. We should strive harder, it seems to me, to get to those points, and we don't always do so. And maybe it's easier for someone like myself who has that foundation to be a little clearer where I stand. That being said, there's a lot of moral dilemmas that come out of genomics that I don't have a good answer to either. I mean, they're much too fuzzy to be able to pinpoint what you think should be done. Particularly this comes up in the area of the application of genomics beyond the area of disease, where I think most of us feel that is a right and moral thing. We should be spending our time trying to alleviate suffering. Look at the life of Christ. How much of his time on this earth, short as it was spent healing people. An incredible amount. He was sending us a message there. This is one of our tasks. And I don't feel any sense of concern at all about being very aggressive in pursuing what we know about genomics to cure terrible diseases. But what about things that aren't diseases? Or that are sort of in this blurry area in between? What about enhancing traits? Whether it's to be sure that children are more successful athletically than they otherwise would have been by their genetic endowment, or perhaps coming up with ways in the next generation of enhancing other features such as musical talent. Frankly, we don't know how to do that, but we may learn how to tweak the odds a bit. You just had in your Congress or your Parliament yesterday this bill about in vitro fertilization and also about stem cells. Stem cell arguments are swirling in the United States. Here's an area where I, as a believer, must tell you I have a lot of uncertainty about where to come down on this issue. The argument about the imperative to heal, a very strong one, says this is a remarkable opportunity to apply a brand new approach to try to treat some terrible diseases like Parkinson or Alzheimer's. The other part of me says human life is to be respected. We should not be tweaking with human embryos without giving this a great deal of thought about what it is that we're doing. And we could have a long conversation about this issue. So while I think it helps me a lot to have some place to go for a foundation, there are a lot of issues that don't necessarily come out so cleanly after that consideration. And I find myself like all of you, in those discussions, trying to contribute what I can, trying to educate people about what the issues are, and hoping that we collectively, by the grace of God, can come up with a decision about what is right and proper and where we really ought to draw a line and say, we're not going to go past that one. Yes?
I think scientists are most likely to find or bump into God if they're always searching. So could the Christian scientist find the Christian God, and could the Jewish or Muslim scientist find the Jewish or Muslim God?
Great question. I'm not sure I agree with your first premise that scientists are the most likely to find God, because again, scientists use the tools of science to study the natural world. In fact, I think that gets in their way. There's an issue here that if you're a scientist, at a certain level, you may be a bit intellectually threatened by the idea of something that science can't explain. And I think that sometimes gets in the way of scientists who might otherwise give more serious consideration to the spiritual. That's not the sort of set of thought processes that we're all trained to follow. But going to the more serious part of your question, what about the faith that one comes to? You may very well say, well, here I am. I am an American raised in a culture where the predominant religion, if there is one, although increasingly there isn't, is Christianity. Isn't it just a little too convenient that after searching through these various faiths, that's the one that I came to? I'll let you draw your own conclusion. I will certainly tell you that I gave pretty serious thought to the other alternatives. And as I tried to explain in the presentation, came to the conclusion that Christianity was either the most completely outlandish and ought to be immediately dismissed, or it had something so powerful and so compelling because of the person of Christ, a person who I discovered, actually, there's a fair amount of historical support for his real existence, not some mythical character. And that, for me, was overwhelmingly compelling. Now, would have I arrived at that same conclusion if I was living in some other culture? I can't tell you, but I'm awfully glad that I was able to come to that conclusion in the culture I'm surrounded by. I think, actually, the great face of this world must have great truths in them, or they would not have long survived. And in fact, there are great truths that are in common between many of the faiths of the world. I think it is up to each person to try to sort through those issues and come up with their own conclusion. But I do think, and this is maybe not a sort of politically correct thing to say, it cannot be true that all faiths of the world are equally valid, because they hold beliefs, some of which are completely in opposition to each other. It would not be logical to say that two things are true if they say the opposite. So while it is, I guess, unpopular in this postmodernist circumstance of plurality, where everybody's beliefs are considered just as good as everybody else's, where sincerity is considered sufficient to be equivalent to truth, those things basically cause people to say, well, we really shouldn't mess with the distinctions. They're all equivalent. They can't be equivalent. That's too easy. So each of us has to find our own truth within there, but you probably won't find it in all the options. Just the same, you'll find a lot of the truths shared amongst the major options, but it is the important differences that also deserve our attention. I'm noting that we have arrived at the point where maybe we should call the questions off, because it was suggested to me that 5:30 would be a good end point. Victor, do you still...
One last burning question.
Who is burning the most here? Right here. Components of the moral law. Not at all. Not at all. I think, in fact, there's this recent experiment with chimpanzees that some of you probably have read about, where the subject of fairness was tested by giving one chimp a reward for a certain action, and then the other chimp carried out the same action and didn't get the reward and got very angry about it, the conclusion being chimps have a sense of what's fair and isn't fair. Well, isn't that kind of like the moral law? That wasn't fair. That wasn't right. This would not bother me. I mean, if evolution is God's way of ultimately ending up with creatures like ourselves, fully formed in the sense of having a conscious sense of ourselves, a fully developed sense of what's right and wrong, and a desire, a reaching out, a longing for relationship with Him, it wouldn't disturb me if along the way certain aspects of that began to appear in a less than fully formed way. That would actually be quite comfortable.
Okay, so thank you.